This evening, we have to speak about the way things are. There's a considerable importance, primary importance we could say, given in Dharma teachings to seeing the way things actually are. And it is recognized that when we don't see the way things are, this leads to suffering. Quite simply, not comprehending what is true, what is actual and real, leads us to ways of behaving and responding to our life and to our world and to ourself that create considerable suffering for ourselves and for others. And the wisdom that we speak of in Dharma teachings is a wisdom born of seeing what is true, which when understood, when comprehended rightly, leads to the reduction and ultimately to the end of suffering in our lives. So it's something that we're concerned with, something that we're interested in, deeply and profoundly. A few years ago, I was just finishing my morning meditation one chilly February morning, and I opened my eyes from the meditation, as one does, and just was looking out through the window in front of me where I lived, and on the windowsill I saw a small snail, and it was just kind of interesting that there was a snail there as I opened my eyes. And my mind clicked into some busy thought, as sometimes you may have noticed your own doing. And the first thought was, how did the snail get in? And then the second thought was pretty obvious, in fact, that it had got in through the open window, which was open even though it was actually very cold on a frosty February morning, because, well, it's kind of a story really. It had needed some repair work. It had swollen up so it couldn't close properly. So I'd had to take a plane and trim some wood off and paint it up so that it could be, you know, in proper working order. But because the paint was wet, I had to leave it open to dry or it would stick solid, you know, whole story. Anyway, that's why the window was open. So the first thought was, why? How did it get in? The second thought is, why did it come in? And I thought, it's probably too cold out there. Snails don't usually survive the winter, do they? And then I thought, but there's nothing for it to eat in here. It's not going to survive. It can't live here either. It can't live out there. It can't live in here. And all this time, this thought's just flickered through my mind in really a moment or two. And I was watching it, and just the sense of the translucent, sort of moist, tender body with those little beady eyes on stalks wobbling along, and the delicate pattern of the spiral shell, and it was just so remarkable, so beautiful, and I just felt all this sense of interest and care for this small sort of being. And I thought, what can I do? If I put it outside, it'll freeze. If I keep it in here, it'll starve. And I thought, I know. I can take it to my neighbour's greenhouse. Well, great, what a solution. Nice and warm, plenty to eat. I won't tell my grand. I won't tell my neighbour. And I just felt so pleased. I'd sort of solved this whole problem. So I got up from my cushion and reached towards the snail, which turned out to be a wood shaving from when I trimmed the wood off the window. And it was a really remarkable moment when this whole, not just this image of the snail, just dissolved, but the whole process that had arisen around it, that whole problem that had occurred, that I'd actually solved, didn't exist. And I'd felt for it so deeply. It was a piece of wood. And it was a really remarkable lesson in how we tend to very quickly draw conclusions from first impressions or appearances. We don't often allow our attention to sink more deeply into our experience. But we're already in our mind. Obviously, the image of the snail came out of my memory. It wasn't existent out there. But I saw it. I saw it moving. It was alive. And we do this a lot of the time. From what must have been a brown blob, a whole construction and creation occurred. And often, because of our misperceptions, based on not really carefully observing, we then find ourselves entangled in suffering. In the meditation practice, we learn to be present. We learn to actually see what is going on and to rest our attention deeply in the experience, just as it is, not adding too much projection or conceptual overlay to the simple, bare experiences, to see what that shows us. In being able to actually see things in that way, we can recognize what is true, reverse the misperceptions that we are often acting or laboring under, and therefore release ourselves from suffering. And the Buddha spoke of three fundamental and significant misperceptions that through our lack of clear seeing the truth in regard to each of these areas, we grasp at our experience. And this grasping leads to suffering. This is identified as the primary cause of suffering. It's the way we grasp at, we try to hold on to our experience, to fix it in a certain way. And the first misperception that the Buddha identified and spoke about a lot, already mentioned, it's the tendency to see things which are changing as somehow being permanent. To relate to things as though they do not change. To act as though things that are now will still be so tomorrow or next year. And to not really understand that all things are changing. When we don't see that things are changing, it easily leads us to a sense of complacency and taking things for granted, which I spoke about some yesterday, where we don't really sense the preciousness of our life. But it also and equally leads to us grasping to try and keep hold of things, wanting to get and keep things and fix them when we can't, when it can't be done. Like trying to grasp a rope that's being pulled through our fingers. We get rope burn. It hurts. It causes suffering. Because we can't hold on to it. We can't fix it. And likewise, we struggle to push away, to get rid of the difficult, the unpleasant. Not understand, because we fear that it's going to stay and be permanent unless we push it away, unless we fight and resist it. But when we understand change as being of the nature of all things, we see that the difficult experiences will actually move and change by themselves. We don't need to push them away and do not serve ourselves by trying to. It's like there's this sense that we can sometimes get in practice of things being changing so quickly. We see the mind states, we see the experiences in our body, the weather, all the different things that are going on. Sometimes we can really sense how quickly they change. In the Diamond Sutra, it suggested we could look on the world in this way. Thus you shall think of all this fleeting world. A star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lantern, a phantom, and a dream. And that those images just evoke a sense of transience, of evanescence, of ephemeral quality to things, to life. And truly, this is how they are. Things are changing so rapidly. Sort of modern quantum science has shown us that everything is only barely existent for less than moments. And only when you look at it in a certain way, and if you look at it a different way, it's not there at all. All the basic material we feel is so solid. And yet we don't see this very easily unless we really pay attention to where we are. We kind of get fooled into thinking things are fixed by the way we dwell in the past and in the future. Because the past and future exist as concepts, as ideas, which we can solidify and fix and believe in. It's a bit like driving in a car. Perhaps it's better to think of this as being a passenger in a car. It could be dangerous if you're driving in a car. Driving in a car on a long, straight road. And if you look straight out the windscreen ahead of you, what do you see? A pretty much unchanging or very slowly changing image of what's kind of out there on the horizon. That's the future. If you turn over, and this is why you shouldn't do it when you're driving, you look out the back for a while, what will you see out the back window? A long straight, pretty much a sort of fixed image of what's out there in the rear horizon. It doesn't look like things are changing that fast. And, you know, we've probably all had that experience of driving very quickly in a car, then being surprised at how things are actually happening very quickly. Because we've somehow not noticed that. But if you look out the side window, directly out to the side of what's beside you going past out the side window in a car, even at a moderate speed, things are flickering past incredibly quickly. And that's where you actually are. In relationship to where you are, the scenery is changing remarkably fast. It's probably a blur at a usual road speed. And the same thing happens in our way of relating. Because we're so fixed on the future and the past, much of the time, we don't see how quickly things are changing. And the more we actually are present and see that things are changing, the more that truth actually settles into us, and we're less likely to believe in the appearance, the illusion of permanence. And the grasping that brings out of us, the attempt to try and control things that brings out. If we see how quickly it's moving, we realize we couldn't control it. It wouldn't make sense to us. And this, how this affects our life, is expressed rather beautifully in a poem by William Blake. He who binds himself to a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives on in eternity's sunrise. The sense of trying to bind oneself to that which gives us joy actually destroys the very joy and possibility of it. And yet to be able to touch that which brings joy and happiness in life, and yet not seek to bind it, not seek to hold it. This is actually what brings us in touch with a timeless beauty of life. So the truth of change invites us to not take hold. To not take hold of our life or of things around us or within us when we see it clearly. And precisely because things are changing as rapidly and uncontrollably as they are, they can't give us satisfaction. They can't give us lasting satisfaction. We can't base ultimate peace or happiness on getting things the way we want them, because they won't stay that way, even if we manage to get them that way, which is pretty unlikely. And this tendency to again look into the world of things and people and conditions with the view that somehow this can give lasting satisfaction. This is the second major misperception. To see clearly is to understand that while we can enjoy and appreciate and make use of what is around us, people, relationships, situations, material things, of course, but not to see them as the source of lasting, permanent or enduring satisfaction, because they haven't got that capacity in them. It's in their nature that they can't do that for us, because they don't last. And there's a sort of sense that comes from that, that's actually a wholesome giving up of that fantasy. In Dante's Inferno, it's described that in the, which is, you know, I think it, probably familiar with at least the name of the book, the sort of a metaphor and story of or image of hell, in which the entrance to hell has the words carved over it, "Abandon hope, all ye who enter here." Least in translation, that's what it says. And it sounds like, you know, you're going somewhere horrible, you might as well give up and be miserable. But actually, it could be a really wise piece of advice. That the actual only basis for surviving in those conditions in a balanced and healthy way is to not be hoping that somehow they're going to do it for you. That they're somehow going to make you happy. Happiness comes from something else. Satisfaction and peace comes from something else. Not the conditions of our life. And as we understand this more, we start to sense that maybe, again, the attempt to control the conditions of our life based on the idea that this will give us happiness doesn't make sense. Which doesn't mean we throw away the ability to do what we can to influence things for wholesome and appropriate results and directions. Of course, that's part of our life. But we don't kind of, as it were, hang our hat or our life's happiness on that ability or capacity. The third major misperception that the Buddha spoke of is the way in which we tend to see in ourselves and other people and in things a sense of an independent self-existing entity, a sense of something which is separate, apart from and unrelated or unconnected to everything else. And there is no such thing. There is no separate, individuated, discrete, removed, existing entity to be found in oneself or in another thing or another being. All things arise dependent upon multiple conditions interacting and influencing each other. And yet we have this incredibly strong sense of me right at the core of our experience, it seems, a sense of I am. It's me, or this life that's mine, and you, and all the others. And that so much of our life is formed and focused around this sense of me, which feels so real, and which people around us seem to affirm and confirm quite committedly. And yet, this misperception is a fundamental cause of suffering. So in the Buddhist teachings, the Dharma teachings, we're not asked to take on a particular position or a belief system or structure. That's really not that useful to us. So the teaching isn't saying you shouldn't believe that you have a self, or you should, having thought that you existed, you should now believe that you don't exist, which isn't really going to be very useful and going to lead to all sorts of questions. Well, like, where did I go now that I don't exist anymore? And how is it that I'm over here and you're over there? It's more an invitation, rather than taking a position of whatever we think it might or might not mean, this teaching of non-self, it's an invitation to look and see what is true in your own experience, to look beyond the appearance, to what is actually there. And what do we see in our experience? What's actually going on here? If we look at this body, mind, living thing happening right now, what we notice, what we see, what we actually can experience is sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touch. It's the five physical senses. Plus thoughts and feelings, which are a composite of mind-body experience. This is what we experience, those six realms of experience. Sight, sound, taste, touch, smell, thoughts. That's it. That's the whole totality of what we experience. And if we look at them, we see they're kind of revealed to consciousness, to awareness. They're known, sometimes consciously anyway. They're going on. They're not going on particularly according to our plan or any plan we might come up with. We're not sort of making it happen in a certain way. We've realized we can't do that. It doesn't happen like that. They're not in our control. And we might ask ourselves, where is the body that we had 10 years ago? What's happened to it? It's not there. And where is the body we'll have in 10 years from now? We're still alive. It's not like it's in a cupboard somewhere waiting to be collected. Even more, where is the mind that we had 5 minutes ago? Where is the mind that was delighting in a blissful experience or despairing at a difficult meditation session earlier today? Where is it right now? Can't find it. Where is the mind that you're going to be having at the end of the talk? Got no idea what it's going to be. Relief, excitement, boredom, interest. Who knows what it's going to be at the end of the talk? Let alone weeks, months, or years from now. And yet somehow we have this sense that there's something in there that's me, to whom all this refers, that's somehow fixed, somehow permanent, that's somehow got a core of solidity to it, other than all these things that I can observe that are changing. But if we look and try and put our finger on it and say, that's it, in a moment it's changed. It's become something else. There isn't something we can actually find within our experience that is substantial or fixed. And again, the Buddha said we should look at this experience of our mind-body process, what we call our mind-body process. And it's not, of course, to dismiss the idea that, you know, there's this mind-body over here and there's that one over there, and that, you know, that they've certainly got their unique characteristics and they express their particular sort of trajectory or pathway through life in different ways. Of course, there is a truth to that, and it's not to sort of somehow try and erase the individuality in which life is expressed, in which what we call our life is expressed. But to look and see if it's changing and it's not in our control, if it's not controllable, if it's not fixed, does it make sense to say that this is who we are, to claim this to be me? To see how we kind of create the sense of self based on our stories that we repeat and tell ourselves and tell each other and hear from other people. Stories of what I believe, what I think. Images of our past, our roles, our activities. Images of our future, our plans, our hopes, our dreams. Our sense of our what our preferences are, what we like, what we don't like, what our habits are, the things we tend to find familiar as ways of being. The qualities that we see within our heart and mind, the wholesome ones and the unwholesome ones. All of that sort of creates a package which we tend to hold very close to. We tend to grasp at, we tend to try to fix onto, to somehow solidify. And we kind of see it, we kind of relate to it most of the time as though it is something that is separate. As though it is a part, as though there's a boundary that stops perhaps with one's skin. And inside it, in this package here, is me, myself, this one. And everything out there is other, is apart, is separate, disconnected, and not of the same nature as what this is. And how do we come to that conclusion? Because the thought comes into the mind and says, it's me, I'm this, or it's mine, I own it. Or it's me and I own it. And yet that thought just pops into the mind, just like all the other thoughts. And yet somehow we believe that one so profoundly, so deeply. Somehow we believe that thought that pops up and claims it. But it is just a thought. And if a thought should go our mind, a thought should go through our mind saying, the moon is made of blue cheese, we wouldn't believe that. So the fact that a thought moves through our mind doesn't mean we have to believe it. But we need to look and see what's the actual experience going on here. And this is particularly important for us if we're interested in suffering and the end of it, coming to peace. What's the effect of living from this point of view? Because this is going to tell us really the truth of it. When we live according to truth, we live in harmony with life rather than in conflict with it. When we live our life according to misperceptions, we constantly find ourselves in conflict with what's going on, with the way things are. And what happens with that sense of I am, this is me, is that the movements of mind and heart that arise within us, we identify with, we claim them. We feel when there's wanting that I want and I must have and I'll be miserable if I don't get. And we're compelled therefore just to constantly chase in pursuit of that which we want. When there's a sense of not wanting arising, of fear, of aversion, resistance, and it's a sense of me, it's me, I don't want this, I don't like this, I can't bear it, I can't stand it, I can't. We feel compelled to have to somehow escape it or push it away or avoid it. And it's like that identification with the movements of heart and mind that we experience, that are experienced, that identification compels us to have to act on them and locks us into the cycle of suffering that is born of grasping and aversion, of clinging to and pushing away life. It creates this sense for us that we have to somehow do our life. We have to make it happen. We have to get it right. And most of the time it looks like we're not doing that very effectively. So not only do we struggle with the fact that it's difficult, but also the fact that somehow we should have done better at it. We should have made a better job of this life. There's an incredible weight that rests upon us through the sense of ownership of our existence. And it's a little bit like someone going for a journey on a train and carrying a big heavy suitcase onto the train. And a story actually told by a teacher in India, where people carry their suitcases on their heads. So the story, and it's kind of looks a bit nicer, a bit more interesting this way. Imagine someone lugging this big suitcase on their head onto the train, going for a long train journey. And in India, train journeys can be very long. So they can in England too. But anyway, having got on the train with the suitcase, keeps it on his head until he gets to his destination. And anyone looking at him might wonder why that person was doing it. Does he not realise that if you put it down beside you, it'll come along with you? You don't actually have to keep it on your head? Our life is a bit like that. The way we kind of try to hold on to it as mine, it's a bit like carrying it on our head. It's really hard work. And to let that go doesn't mean that somehow we get lost from it. It's not like losing your luggage. That's something quite different. But it's actually a relationship to the life in which life carries itself along. And yet one is there, present, conscious, engaged, you know. Might need to get something out of our suitcase now and then. Fine. But again, you don't pick the thing up and put it on your head to get something out of it. To see that our, what we call our existence, is not something apart from all of existence, is not something apart from all of life. To see that suffering exists in life, certainly. There is suffering, and yet we do not need to become that suffering or be the owners of it. Because it's not just our life, your life, my life, any particular person we point to, their life, that has suffering. All lives are touched by this element of experience. It's universal. And when we feel that it's me and it's mine and my fault or my life, someone else's fault, my life, or my fault and my life, we feel it like that when we're identified with it. So much blame, so much struggle. And we can't really open to the fact that this is just how it is. Because in life, equally there is beauty, equally there is sweetness and nobility and joy. And equally that's not mine or someone else's, but it's there. And yet we're so much caught up in the struggle, grappling with life, that we can't really quite open to that. And there's something of the key is in that sense of how we hold the sense of who I am in relationship to life. How the sense of what we experience, what is experienced, is what we are. These thoughts and smells and sounds and sensations and relationships and contacts and this incredible, varied and mysterious flux of processes going on in life. Yet if we can actually just rest in a quality of seeing, just seeing what's happening, that resting and that seeing that doesn't have a quality of ownership in it. It's not about disconnecting or separating ourselves from or becoming distant in any way, but simply that not trying to take hold of, not grasping onto. There's a natural letting go of the force of craving and of fear when we simply rest in seeing life unfolding. And although our perception of the way things are, the way we tend to see things as so fixed and solid, as permanent, as in their permanence offering us something permanent, and in the sense of our own permanence, having a sense of solidity and fixity that we identify with, we can actually find this so compelling, so strong, but by actually just looking and seeing, is it so? Look for ourselves, is it so? We can actually come to see the world in a profoundly different way. Come to see ourselves, what we call ourselves, and of course we can still use the language, in a profoundly different way. It's not about somehow obliterating our existence, but understanding that the appearance of it does not reveal every dimension of its truth. Just as the appearance of a snail does not necessarily mean that something's life is in danger. And we can, in not being so identified with what we call the sort of this individual expression or manifestation of life, we actually start to sense our participation in a kind of seamless way with something much greater. There's a story of a Taoist master who lived in the hills in China a few centuries ago. And he lived in a small hut and practiced meditation with great commitment, and at times would wander down to the villages and talk to the village people and speak to them of his understanding of the Tao, the way things are. And it so happened that a Confucian council in the local major town heard about this old man, and they were a little bit concerned because there was obviously a bit of a wild card and not fitting in with their sort of neat and tidy ideas of how things should go. Having some sort of wandering mystic meditator master up in the hills didn't sound too healthy. So they sent a delegation up to check him out. And this party came up and found the hut and knocked on the door. There was no response. So they just opened it and burst in to find the master sitting cross-legged with no clothes on in the middle of the floor of an empty hut. "What's going on?" said the leader of the party. No response. "What's going on? I want to know. What are you doing sitting here in this hut with no pants on?" And the master looked up at him and said, "What do you know from your limited perspective? From where I'm sitting, this whole world is my hut. This hut is my pants. And I want to know, what are you doing in my pants?" What if we were to let go of our sense of ownership? Our voice, for instance, doesn't always necessarily last the distance, so I've got to finish this one quickly. What if we were to let go of the belief that our body, our thoughts, our emotions, our past, our future, even our present, somehow defines who we are? Without taking another position that says it's not who we are, which is equally problematic, because it's clearly not someone else. What if we were to just rest in our experience, just as it is, really wholeheartedly conscious? We might, in that simple presence and being, find that there is a dimension of vastness, of unbounded boundarylessness, which is actually most fundamentally true. And that to actually allow ourselves to enter into that, we have to really pass through a gateway that will always present itself to us as something uncomfortable, unfamiliar and scary, because we don't know into what we enter when we let go of our attachment to who we are and what we believe and think. And yet it's as though we were to step out the door of a plane in mid-flight just to realize in that moment we've left our parachute behind, and we can just imagine that first realization. And then to realize that actually there's no ground. To actually let go is to actually have to pass through the fear of death. To find actually that there is nothing ultimately that dies, that there is no ground which the person leaving the plane will hit. And then it's not falling, it's flying. To not presume to know, to abide in a condition of innocence that is interested to understand, curious, and yet really connected and present. What we truly are is not and cannot be defined or limited by the content of our experience, of what goes on within us and what goes on around us. That very sense of inner and outer itself cannot be sustained in the face of the clear penetration of awareness into this moment. Learning to let go. Learning to let go. It all comes down to that. And what we let go into is a vastness that is immanent, that is boundless, and that is profoundly ungraspable. May all beings see beyond appearances. May all beings understand the nature of things. May all beings know the truth that is unbound.